Coming up on Golf Today, John Rahm takes to the mic in the Middle East, talking PGA Tour live negotiations and whether or not he will be at the Ryder Cup, two-time major champ, letting it fly in Dubai. We also have Nick Dunlap checking in from the California desert to relive last year's history-making week at the American Express. He will join us live. And Tiger has made some history along the way, but tonight he makes his debut on TGL. Hitting shots in the sim. May the best team win. It's Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Hello and welcome. It's Golf Today on a Tuesday. I'm Damon Hack. He is Eamon Lynch of Golf Week magazine. Yes, Tiger Woods will make his debut on TGL. Excited to see the 15-time major champ just with golf clubs in his hands.
Yeah, it's not often we get to see Tiger these days. It's not often we get to see anybody on a wintry Tuesday. But, it's going to be interesting. They certainly got a lot of good eyeballs on that product last week when they launched. Maybe we're going to see the proof of their strategy of actually holding Tiger for week two and holding Rory, I believe, for week four on this. So there's certainly going to be a lot of eyeballs following Tiger tonight.
So there's golf in Florida and also golf in California. Yes, after 2 weeks in Hawaii, the PGA Tour returns to the continental U.S. for the 66th edition of the American Express Tournament. Is played over three courses, the Stadium Course and the Nicklaus Tournament Course, both at PGA West and La Quinta Country Club out in the Coachella Valley. How about some notables who you'll see this week? Sam Burns, got Patrick Cantlay, the UCLA Bruin, Wyndham Clark, Nick Dunlap, who made that history 1 year ago, Tony Finau, healthy, Billy Horschel, Sungjae Im, Tom Kim, who's a part of Tiger's team, by the way, Nick Taylor, who won last week at the Sony, and Justin Thomas. You see a note there at the bottom, world number two, Xander Schauffele, withdrew on Monday.
Well, last year it was an amateur who made history at the American Express. Alabama sophomore Nick Dunlap took down some of the best players in the world, becoming the first amateur to win on the PGA Tour since 1991. With that victory, the 20-year-old became the second youngest winner on tour since World War II. And here's a pretty impressive list to be part of. Amateurs to win on the PGA Tour since 1940. It's only happened four times in almost 70 years on the PGA Tour, and the most recent, Mr. Dunlap.
Yeah, and after that win in January, he made the decision to turn professional. Then in July, he made history again, winning the Barracuda Championship, becoming the first player in tour history to win as both an amateur and a professional in the same year. About that, I mean, I love getting that second victory, kind of confirmation. And that incredible 2024 was recognized by his peers as he was named the Rookie of the Year on the PGA Tour, winning the Arnold Palmer Award. How great to have Nick Dunlap with us from the California desert. You made that history, Nick, 1 year ago. What's it like being back on property, just driving up and reliving all those wonderful memories from 2024?
Yeah, it's pretty nice to be back. I came back for a little media day, about 2 weeks ago, and it was weather was definitely a little bit warmer than this. But no, great to be back, and this place is as perfect as I remember it.
Nick, when you came here a year ago, you were 4,129th in the world rankings. You left there 68th. You're now 32nd. Does this actually feel normal to you yet, or does it still feel like you're on some kind of a crazy ride?
I'd say it feels a little bit more normal than it did back then, for sure. I think the first, 3-4 months after that was definitely a whirlwind, and couldn't quite tell where I was half the time. But no, it's definitely a little bit more normal for me. I think I'm, starting to get into the swing of things out here and find my rhythm, find my routine, and especially now that I actually know where I'm going for a week, that's nice. So it'll be the next couple events will be my second time playing, so at least I'll have that going for me.
Was there a moment or a conversation with someone along the way when you realized that your life had actually changed for good?
Yeah, I don't think it was just one particular moment. I just think it was week after week. I still kind of have to pinch myself a little bit. I think a lot of these guys are have been my idols, somebody that I've looked up to my entire life, watching on TV, and now they're my peers, and I get to play against them week in and week out, and it's definitely a dream come true.
Nick, there's a story I read on PJTour.com that said a week before last year's American Express, you shot 60 at the North River Yacht Club. What do you remember about that round? Can you confirm that? I mean, that's going low before getting your first win on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, it was a weird start. You know, I typically don't play that well in the winter. I'm in the woods. I don't play a ton of golf during that, you know, November to January. So to kind of come out swinging it really, really well was different for me. But yeah, I shot 60 Saturday before I flew out, and then played well in all three of the practice rounds, and I just was on a little bit of a heater there for about a week.
Nick, you mentioned earlier that you're now seeing venues for the second time. How big a factor is that in terms of your comfort level out there on tour, where you're not actually flying blind every week this year the way you were last year?
Yeah, I just think it's a little bit less stressful that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of being like, okay, you know, I don't have to see the entire golf course if maybe rest is a little bit more important, especially kind of coming off last week for me with red eye last night. It's like, okay, I don't have to get out to the golf course Monday. I can kind of take that day off and maybe rest a little bit Tuesday morning and kind of get into a better routine of I can recover on my body instead of there being a urgency of me having to see the golf course. So I think that'll definitely help me the next couple weeks.
Nick, I remember speaking to you in Houston, and you were kind of torn about whether remaining in Tuscaloosa, one of the great, you know, college towns in the country, or following the siren songs in South Florida with so many PGA Tour and other professionals. Kind of where are you on that? Are you ready to kind of be all in to South Florida, or do you still have those pangs for the college days?
No, I have both places as of right now, and I'll kind of bounce back and forth. It's nice. It's nice to have that Tuscaloosa place. I can still see some football games, and I want to go back and watch a couple of basketball games. Our basketball team's looking really good. I've watched them in the past couple games, but no, I've spent a lot of time in South Florida, especially over the off season, fishing a little bit down there, and then it's hard to beat the weather this time of the year. It's, you know, 75 and perfect pretty much every single day, so I can definitely get a lot more done down there than I would be in Tuscaloosa right about this time.
Do you feel a little different pressure heading into 2025, Nick, in terms of having won as an amateur, you've won as a pro, you're now firmly in the top 50 in the official world golf rankings? Do you feel as though there's a greater expectation, or do you expect more of yourself?
I always expect maybe too much of myself. So, you know, I've got a couple things I need to get better at. And I think from an entire year last year, I got to really see where my game was at, and I kind of assessed that when the year was over. So I've got a plan of a few things I need to get better on. And I'd like to enjoy myself a little bit more out here. I think I was pretty hard on myself last year, so that's definitely one of my goals as well. But I'd like to see some progression in a few areas, and you know, contend in some of these bigger events and some majors, and you know, feel like once 25 wraps up that I'm heading in the right direction for 26.
Can you give us a sense on what you're working on in particular without giving away any state secrets, any part of the game specifically, whether it's off the tee or closer to the green, that you'd like to tighten up a little bit?
Yeah, I don't think there's any secrets in this game. I just think it's hard. But no, I definitely around the greens inside of 50 yards needs to get a little bit better, and off the tee. I've learned that a driver can be a huge weapon out here if used properly, and I think I've gotten a lot better course management, kind of figuring out some of these more difficult golf courses, and how do I make them more boring, I should say. How can I shoot two under par or one under par when I'm not feeling it that day? Definitely driver and definitely chipping. I think those are two parts of my game that stuck out last year to me that needed some work.
Nick, this is a question that doesn't get asked much to guys who've only been professional for a year, but how much is the Ryder Cup on your mind this year and making that team?
Yeah, it's I would probably say number one. It's something I've always thought would be an absolute experience and a dream come true for me, and to represent your country's way more than just playing for yourself every week. So I always watched it as a kid growing up, and to be there at Bethpage wearing the red, white, and blue would be awesome.
You know, we talked about the physical part of the game. You've worked for a long time with Dr. Brett McCabe. How much do you still kind of lean on him during a long season so you're not so hard on yourself, which sometimes you can tend to be?
Yeah, a lot. I talk to him a good bit. It just depends week to week kind of what I'm dealing with or what I'm going through or how I'm feeling. Sometimes it could be every day, morning and evening, and sometimes I may not talk to him for a week and a half. And we've got a really cool relationship that it started when I was probably 10 or 11 years old. And he's been somebody that I'm very, very grateful to have in my corner and have in my life. And I definitely don't take that for granted.
We're grateful for the storyline you gave us 1 year ago. Best of luck in your title defense, Nick. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
There he is, the pride of the University of Alabama. Where were you 1 year ago when Nick Dunlap made history holding off the likes of Justin Thomas and Sam Burns to win on the PGA Tour as an amateur? Back on Golf Today, the 21st edition of the Jones Cup Invitational finished on Sunday as many of the best amateurs from around the world competed at beautiful Sea Island, Georgia. The winner? Florida State's Gray Albright beat his teammate Jack Bigham with a par putt on the first hole of a playoff to take the title. You see how dark it got, and he was able to get the job done. He's now a Florida State University grad student, by the way. He's the champ of the Jones Cup 2024 All-ACC selection, currently 18th on the PGA Tour University ranking, and great to have Gray with us on this Tuesday. Congratulations. So the sun is setting. The moon was out. What was it like competing in that scene that we all dream about, chasing the sunset?
Yeah, it was so cool. I mean, being able to compete against my teammate Jack and both of us playing so well at such an awesome venue in Ocean Forest it's so cool. And the staff there does such a good job of running such a great tournament. And it was cool and interesting to finish in the dark there on that playoff hole.
Is it tougher to compete in a playoff like that, Gray, when you're up against one of your own teammates?
Yeah, it's. I'd say it's a little bit different. Definitely because, you know, I mean, we've done it a few times here at home whether it's in qualifying or something where we're playing against each other. So it has a little bit of a level of comfortability to it, but it's also weird because normally you're rooting for that guy, and this time you want to take him down. But it was really fun to be able to play against him.
I heard you won the first college event you ever played in, the Seminole Intercollegiate. Did that put pressure on you? Did it free you up? I mean, not a lot of college players can say, yeah, I won the first tournament I ever played.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was really fun to get that win and just to be able to go out there and show what I can do and gave me a lot of confidence moving forward, going to other college tournaments and knowing that I could do it and compete with the best double mom. Yeah, it was good to see.
On the subject of your teammates, Gray, Luke Clanton, also on your team, when you look at him on tour and you see the amazing things he's done in the last few months, do you look at Luke and say, you know what, I do that just as well as he does. I can hang at that level as well?
Yeah, it's pretty inspiring to see watching him over the last however long it's been playing on tour and doing so well in those tournaments. But yeah, he's been really good about sharing his experiences and kind of telling me all about what it's about. And it's been fun to be able to play him in matches when we're both here in Tallahassee. But it's just so beneficial to have a guy like that that's been through those things and seen what it's like at the next level and to be able to share all those things with us.
School pride in the state of Florida is no joke. We see the big FSU behind you. Where are you? Is that your bedroom? Are you at the disco? Is that the school office? Well, where do we find you today?
Yeah, I'm in the football stadium right now. This is, I would like to have one of these big old FSU lights in my room, but yeah, this is a good spot we got here.
Well, you grew up in Ocala. We have a friend in common, Ryan Gray. You grew up at Golden Ocala Golf and Equestrian Club. They have that beautiful like stretch of tribute holes. You used to go out there as a kid, swinging left-handed. What do you recall about those days, hanging out with the likes of Ryan and Kate and Palmer, who's just growing by the day?
Yeah, I have such fond memories of that time. And Ryan and Kate Gray have been so good to me. Ryan's been been the guy there for as long as I can remember, and he's just been awesome to me as far as helping me out whenever I needed. And Golden Ocala is just such a great spot and such an awesome course with really cool replica holes and great practice facilities. And yeah, I'm just really grateful for everything Golden Ocala and Ryan Gray has done for me.
There are a lot of PGA Tour winners with their names on the Jones Cup, some major winners with their names on it as well. What does that feel like, or have you taken a moment yet, Gray, to just look at those names and realize that yours is now etched there beside them?
Yeah, it's really, really cool. After I won, I got a chance to look at all the different names that have won it before me, and it's just so cool to see, like, Ludwig has won it, and seeing what he's done being out on tour this last year. Justin Thomas, and I mean, there's just such a long list of guys that have won it that have gone on to have great success, and it's just a really, really cool position to be in, and to have my name on that list as well is pretty awesome.
Gray, what's next for you? I mean, do you want to chase the dream on the PGA Tour, be a doctor, come sit at the desk at Golf Today, be a golf broadcaster? What's next in line for you?
Right. My dream has always been PGA Tour. It's been my dream for as long as I can remember, and I'm definitely going to chase that for sure.
Well, you're off to a great start. It's great to meet you, Gray. Congratulations, and stay in touch. Hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Gray Albright, the winner of the 2025 Jones Cup. Stay with us, folks. John Rahm met with the media in Dubai and made it known that he plans to be on the Ryder Cup team at Bethpage for Europe. Hear his comments when Golf Today returns.
Let's take a look at what's happening this week as the first Rolex Series event of the year gets underway with the Hero Dubai Desert Classic. It's in its 36th edition now on the DP World Tour's international swing. It started back in 1989, it's been held every year since with the exception of 1991 when it was cancelled due to the Gulf War.
Here's some names you know, some live golfers in the field this week. Tyrrell Hatton, Adrian Mouronk, Thomas Peters, Patrick Reed, the two-time major champ, and John Rahm. When you look back at his year in 2024, you know, not the year he probably envisioned, T45 at the Masters, missed the cut at the PGA, had that foot infection, not able to play at Pinehurst number two, T7 at the Open, had that three-shot lead entering the final nine at the Olympics, closing 39 to drop off the podium, tie for fifth, lost in a playoff at the Spanish Open, and had a couple of wins and 12 top 10s on LIV, but it didn't really leave a mark. So let's hear from Rahm, not on the state of his game, but on the state of the game.
As we start 2025, what is your assessment on where professional golf is? And is it where you expected it would be at this point?
It's hard to tell at this point. I think a lot of us would say that when that framework agreement was done over a year and a half ago, things would be further along at this point. And I truly don't know what goes on behind those closed doors, right? It's up to people much higher up than me. And I don't know what their vision is or what they're expecting out of it, right? I think so many of us want some kind of resolution to come together and get the best product possible out there for the consumer, which is what I think we're still in a position to do. I think we're living in a golden era right now for golf where the possibilities are endless, right? You have a big tour in Europe and worldwide. You have a massive tour on the PGA Tour. You have another big product with LIV. And now you even add in the TGL, right? When it comes to golf, the possibilities are there right now. And I think with the right minds put together, you can end up with a product, and I've been saying this all along, that could put golf in a different level in the world of sports. So I'm still hopeful that can happen, and whatever it looks like, whatever it looks like. But we're in that position nowadays to put golf in a higher level, and I hope that happens.
Martin,
John, just to follow up to Ewan's question, you're about to head into your second season on LIV. Did you really, honestly think a year ago that there'd be no world ranking points available yet? A year on from when you joined. And how frustrating is that going to become for you going forward?
I think I've expressed my opinions on the world ranking system before I even joined LIV. But they told me early on, I think even before I signed on the early conversations, that they were not going to pursue the that discussions, those discussions at, to the same level because they knew where it was directed, right? I think at this point, to not give Liv world ranking points and the credibility it deserves, I think is wrong. I think, listen, I understand we've all made a decision and it's not as easy as it sounds, but to say that Liv players don't deserve some spots in major championships, I think is wrong. And I hope that evolves into what it should be, right? I think Joaquin Niemann has done a good enough job for him to earn his way into majors without needing invites, right? I think he's played good enough. I think Taylor Gooch a couple of years ago played good enough to earn his way into majors. So I think there should be a way for us to qualify. And world ranking points, yeah, I think they need to figure something out because it's not fair for anybody in that sense.
John Rahm has been vocal about his view on Liv golfers in the official world golf ranking points. Where should he point his vitriol, at Greg Norman or at the folks that make the decisions at the OWGR?
Well, if he's got a gripe with the official world golf rankings, John Rahm really ought to call Greg Norman because there is no application before the official world golf rankings. Now, Liv withdrew that application last year. They explicitly said they weren't going to meet the criteria necessary to qualify for world ranking points. In fact, one of the concerns that the OWGR had raised was the relegation and promotion system of players coming in and out of the league, and Liv actually narrowed that process this year. If there's a misleading narrative that has been cast here, it wasn't cast from the official World Golf Ranking, it was cast by Liv Golf. And he's right in the sense that, you know, people who play well ought to have access to majors, but that's a decision for the major championships. That's not a decision for the World Golf Ranking. And he mentioned Joaquin Niemann, who last week received an invitation to the Masters for the second year in a row. And it was very clear in the Masters both years when they've explained why Joaquin Niemann justified a special invitation. It's because he made an effort to play and played well outside of the Liv ecosystem. And the message from Augusta was very clear that if you play well and you make an attempt to play well in credible tournaments on other tours, that being a member of Liv will not be held against you. You can still play. But if you choose to play only within Liv, then if you sit on your couch, as Taylor Gooch has done for the last 2 years, well, then you'll be sitting on your couch the second week in April as well. And there's no reason why that ought to change. Anyone who plays on Liv has every opportunity to play elsewhere to make a case for themselves. But they don't want to do that. They just simply want to imagine that the rules are for others and not for them.
Well, John doesn't have to worry about being exempt in majors. He won the Masters in 2023. But I can't help but look at him and think back to how great his story was coming from Spain, moving to the United States, recruited to Arizona State, became the best amateur in the world, played for Tim Mickelson, how much he seemed to enjoy being on the PGA Tour. And then he leaves in December of 2023, and what a gut punch it was to the game, I believe, especially considering, you know, the style of play that he brought, the energy, the animation, the fire. And I think that we're seeing the results of that in the majors especially. He's just not playing to the level that he was, and I think he's almost like looking for oxygen. He was someone that would, you know, emote. And you need a big crowd, and you need history. He was keenly aware of what wins would mean, like winning in San Diego and the history of the old Andy Williams, or winning the Irish Open and knowing that Seve had won. I mean, he was keenly winning in Dubai and knowing, you know, well, how many had Rory won? How many had Seve? Like, Colin Montgomery, he was aware of that history. Liv just doesn't have it. And I almost feel like somewhere in the reaches of his soul, he's, like, been deprived of that. And I think that's why we haven't seen the results that we saw just a couple of years ago when it comes to John Rahm and the big events.
He's definitely a guy who seems to be playing without context. And he did enjoy the context of where he was being measured against other people in the game, whether it was past generations or even against current players. And I tend to think that one off year for him is probably too small a sample size to conclude that going to Liv has somehow diminished him as a player. I don't believe that. He's currently 31st in the world golf rankings. I do not believe there are 30 players in the world than John Rahm, but those are the decisions John Rahm made, and the consequences are that he's not getting those ranking points. And he, in a way, he's right in the comments that he made there about there is a vast blank landscape in the game right now, and who knows what that is going to be. Perhaps it is actually going to end up something that is better for the consumers. The consumers aren't seeing it right now, But it's a little rich when you hear it, and this isn't just a LIV player thing. You hear it on the PGA Tour as well. How many players are suddenly now kind of clutching their pearls and saying it's time to get a good unified product and worry about the consumer after they've gotten paid.
Yeah.
As long as they've got theirs, then they'll turn around to worry about the good of the game and the consumers. That kind of sticks in the throat a little bit.
No doubt about it. Well, John Rahm covered a lot of ground on this Tuesday, including whether or not we will see him at the Ryder Cup for Team Europe in the fall.
The Team Cup last week got us, a lot of us, thinking Ryder Cup. Can I just get you to clarify your position? Obviously, we know you've got the appeal against the fines to be held. If that is heard before the Ryder Cup, would you settle the account and still make yourself available?
I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but I can tell you my plan is to be on that team at Bethpage.
So that would be, regardless of the outcome of the appeal, you would make yourself available?
I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm hoping they don't try to settle the appeal before the Ryder Cup. I don't think that would be good for anybody.
Right.
But my plan is to be at Bethpage.
There's another example of John thinking the rules ought to be bent to accommodate Liv. I mean, the situation here is very clear. Whether his appeal against the fines and the decisions of the DP World Tour will be heard by the same sports arbitration system that initially found on behalf of the European Tour and allowed them to impose fines on guys who went and played Liv. He doesn't have to pay those fines until his case is adjudicated.
Right.
If it is adjudicated, then his eligibility for the Ryder Cup becomes quite murky because it's also up in the air whether or not he wants to pay the fines. So he's basically saying, let's not even have a trial until I can have my moment at the Ryder Cup. And he's suggesting he doesn't really want to pay the fines. Other Sergio Garcia has said that he is willing to pay the fines and try to resume the membership of the DP World Tour that he resigned to try to work his way on there. And, you know, the Ryder Cup team is clearly going to be better with John Rahm on it.
100%.
He's an asset. He's not essential. There's plenty of talent there. It would be measurably better with him. But it's not a killer blow if John Rahm isn't
on
there.
On the road, it's not a killer blow?
I don't John think Rahm. It would be. I think there's plenty of talent there. It would clearly be preferable if he wasn't. But his hope seems to be that his actions with the DP World Tour will not be adjudicated and that he will not actually have to make a decision on how much he wants to be
but
there.
But why even do that?
Checkbook.
Why joust with the DP World Tour? He met the minimum playing requirement last year. If for some reason it is adjudicated before the Ryder Cup, don't you think he would just quietly pay his fines and make sure he is side by side with Rory McIlroy? It seems like in this latest incarnation that the Ryder Cup kind of is on top of all, and that in this fractured time in professional golf, that, you know what, putting on that European crest is bigger than any schism in the game. Don't you think that John Rahm would be out of his mind to somehow say, oh, well, now I'm not going to pay these fines? The man's making a dollar. Come on. This is the Ryder Cup we're talking about. You don't want to miss the Ryder Cup.
You would certainly hope that when it comes to it, that he will find the way to observe the rules that have been put in place and do what's necessary. He's not being told you can't play the Ryder Cup. He's been told this is the process for you to play the Ryder Cup. And he's seeming to suggest that he's not that keen on what the process is. Well, it will potentially be John Rahm's decision. If it is adjudicated before then, he's going to have a decision to make. If it's not adjudicated until after the Ryder Cup, well then, as of now, he's eligible, and I would expect to see him at Bethpage.
Yeah. Are you surprised to see on whether it's talking about the American team or the European team, that, hey, I don't care where you play. If you can help us win, we want you on that team. Before, it seemed like, well, I don't want, you know, we're different leagues. We're fractured tours. It seems like in 2025 and even at the end of 2024, it was more. But even Rory McIlroy seemed to have changed his tune. But, hey, listen, I want to win the Ryder Cup. This is more important than any fracture or division in the game. But are you surprised that it's come to that, or does that speak to the enormity of the Ryder Cup?
It doesn't surprise me, but it's also reflective of the nature of who owns the Ryder Cup. It's not a PGA Tour event on the United States side. They have no business adjudicating anything on the Ryder Cup, and they're only involved to the extent that how one performs on the PGA Tour often heavily impacts where you are clearly in the rankings to make a Ryder Cup team. But it is not a PGA Tour event. The DP World Tour does own the other half of it. So whenever they have adjudicated against players with fines or suspensions or sanctions of some kind, that also has an impact on how they can qualify for it, but it is their event. Yeah. So there isn't quite the same clear break in ownership and any kind of onerous sanctions on the European side and the US side. It's not really an apples to apples comparison, but it shouldn't really matter. Mm. And it won't matter to the captains. I don't think Keegan Bradley cares what tour any player is competing on.
Yeah.
If he thinks that guy can win him points at Bethpage.
Expect to see Brooks and Bryson wearing red, white, and blue for Keegan. I expect to see John Rahm wearing blue, gold, and white for Luke Donald.
Well, let's hope all of them are there. I might actually suggest that we're getting somewhere this game. Well, let's take a look at the team event that isn't actually as contentious these days. Stay with us. It's a big night ahead in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Tiger Woods making his TGL debut. We're going to take a closer look at this new venture with sports business journalist Josh Carpenter. That's on the other side of this break. Well, last week, TGL debuted at the SoFi Center in South Florida when the New York Golf Club took on the Bay Golf Club. The Bay, of course, went on to win that opening session. It was Shane Lowry, Ludwig Oberg, Wyndham Clark representing the San Francisco team. They had an easy 9-2 victory. Well, tonight, one of TGL's founders, Tiger Woods, makes his first appearance alongside his Jupiter Links Golf Club. Three of the four team members playing, Woods alongside Kevin Kisner and Max Homa. And Homa playing against his actual hometown of LA. Justin Rose, Colin Morikawa and Sahith Theegala taking the field for LA tonight. Josh Carpenter joins us now. Josh is the assistant managing editor at Sports Business Journal covering this game. And Josh, the TGL drew pretty impressive viewership in its first week. It's reasonable to assume Tiger is going to draw more eyeballs this week. Is there a time frame in mind where we do get a real sense of what the lasting audience traction for this product is? Is it a matter of weeks? Is it a full season in your mind?
Yeah. Eamon and Damon, it's good to see you. It's good to join you. I think we'll probably have to wait to the end of the season to see what the audience looks like. I know their audience for week one certainly outdrew, I think, their expectations. And certainly you have to expect you'll see a gain on that tonight with Tiger playing. But if you look at their schedule throughout the rest of the season, they've got a mix of time slots. I mean, they've got matches. Tonight's at 7 o'clock, for example. You've got more matches at 9 o'clock. You've got they've got a triple header on President's Day, I think at 1, 4, and 7 o'clock. They've got some matches later on in the season at 3 o'clock. So, and those matches will air on ESPN2, which has a lesser distribution than ESPN. So you're going to see certainly some smaller numbers than what you saw last week, what you see tonight, what you're probably going to see when Tiger's team and Rory's team play each other here in a couple weeks. So I think you'll need to wait till the end of the season to really look at that season-long average, what they did, is TGL happy, is ESPN happy, to figure out kind of what the lasting audience will be, Eamon.
Well, Josh, a lot of us wondered how week one, you know, would kind of come off. Would there be technical glitches? How would it play being in person? You were there. What was your biggest takeaway from week number one?
My biggest takeaway, Damon, is first of all, and Mike McCarley, the founder of Tomorrow Sports Group, which is the parent company TGL, he'll tell you this is a TV product first. Mike is a TV guy. He was the president of the network that we're speaking on right now for a long time. This is a TV product first. And so I still have yet to see it on TV. I was there in person, like you mentioned, last week. So I'm going to reserve judgment until I watch it on TV. Being in the venue, I think certainly it was week one, right? So they had some hiccups. They've got some room to improve. One of the big selling points of TGL in the lead up to launch is that you would be able to hear player comments. You know, they'd be mic'd up. You'd be able to hear the trash talk, strategy, all that. If you were in venue last week as a fan, you could not hear any of that unless you were so close to the playing field that you could hear it. There was no type of way to hear what was being said, you know, in between shots while they were over shots. The TGL, some officials with the league did say that eventually they plan on kind of providing fans with some earpieces so that they can listen in, similar to what you'd have at an Open Championship, at a U.S. Open. that was probably my biggest takeaway. I thought it was a good experience, but I felt a little bit disconnected and like I needed to sort of catch up. You know, if you go to the Masters where you can't have a cell phone, you have no connectivity down there. When you get back to the media center, you get back to your home, you feel like you need to catch up a little bit on what happened. And I felt that way a little bit after I was done watching the in-venue, you know, the gameplay last week.
On that subject.
But overall, I will say, overall, the technology is very impressive. It's something new, right? It's very new to the game of golf, a new spin on things. So from that aspect, it was really something to behold and be there and see in person.
On that subject, Josh, of trying to find connectivity with an audience, there's a clear attempt here to try to drive geographic loyalty in the same way that the old World Team Tennis used to do years ago by basing them in cities. But the LA team doesn't play in LA, and the same with New York and Boston and Atlanta. Only tonight's team, Jupiter, actually has home games. Do you think that it would need some kind of green grass component or expansion to those cities to actually develop any kind of regional loyalty on the basis that they're after?
I think it could certainly help, Eamon. I won't say that I would necessarily see a venue being placed in a city to draw fans to a certain team. I think if you look at expansion for TGL, it might be more in a sense of making a little bit easier for players to participate. Let's say Las Vegas is a city that's been tossed out as a potential, you know, host site for another TGL venue. It'd be a lot easier for a PGA Tour player to fly from Kapalua to Las Vegas for a TGL event and then to the California desert for a PGA Tour event than it is to fly from Kapalua to, you know, South Florida, then back to California. And the TGL, they do have an airline deal that, you know, charters those players from that. But still, just thinking about time, I think, you know, we've heard, you know, possible venues in Las Vegas. You think about Scottsdale as a hotbed. I think the West Coast would make sense because the early portion of the PGA Tour schedule when these matches are being played is, where is it played? It's primarily on the West Coast. You know, so I think that would make more sense than putting a venue, say, in New York where they have a team, or Boston where they have a team. You know, a lot of the TGL officials would tell you, well, the New York Yankees, yes, they're based in New York, but how many players on the Yankees are actually from New York? And so, yes, they want to build those team and those city identities, but they don't necessarily think it's based in having a team located in those cities and areas.
Josh, what about expanding beyond golfers? In your discussions with Mike include, you know, bringing in some of those investors, a Steph Curry hitting some shots, Serena Williams, or kind of reaching out to the celebrity world to try to grow the tent that way?
Yeah, I mean, Mike didn't mention anything specifically. Now, he has talked about, since Tomorrow Sports was launched, that TGL was simply just the first project of many within Tomorrow. So I think they want to nail that first. He would tell you that. He said he spends maybe 5 to 10% of his time on kind of other projects outside of TGL. They want to make sure they get that first year right. But Damon, it's really easy to imagine getting a celebrity component in there playing in the 9 months where this venue isn't used for competition, right? Because TGL season ends late March, I believe, before the Masters. And so you've really got a full 9 months there to experiment, to maybe bring in celebrities, to try out, you know, who knows, other sports. Just, I know Mike wants to really, with these other projects he's working on, he wants to put that kind of innovative spin on it, right? We all know a football game's 3.5 to 4 hours. We all know a round of golf is 4.5 hours. But in TGL, a round of golf is 2 hours, right? So how do you truncate that, make it, you know, add in the technology aspect, bring in some celebrities maybe, and that sort of thing, to just put a new spin on some of these sports and things like that.
I just want to shift topics a little bit, Josh. Earlier this week, you wrote about the prospects of LIV Golf potentially getting closer to a deal with Fox Sports. Given that it's the fifth event of the LIV season before, all the way into April, before they actually show up, I suppose, within the US time zones anywhere, how impactful do you think that could be to LIV if most of their events, a majority of the entire season actually, has been played in the overnight hours in the United States?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Eamon. I think certainly you know, I don't know the exact details of their deal with Fox, which we've reported on. I think it's probably going to come down in the next week or so. You know, I would imagine they'll probably air those on tape delay when they're in, you know, Riyadh to start the season in Australia, probably on tape delay, whether it's on Fox or on Fox Sports 1. But I think even if it's on tape delay, Eamon, just the idea of them being on Fox compared to the CW is a big step up. But I'll also say that the caveat to that is that I think they really have to deliver. You know, there are no excuses anymore about, well, viewership was lower because we were on the CW. They'll be on Big Fox now. Not for every event, but if they're on Big Fox, to me, there aren't really excuses. You've got big names like we've talked about. You've got the Jon Rahm, the Koepkas, the DeChambeaus of the world. You've got, you know, a different format than what you see week to week on the PGA Tour. And you're on a big network. So I think they have to deliver. They've got a new CEO coming on board this year in Scott O'Neill. They really have to deliver on TV with their commercial partners to make some inroads. Not that they haven't made inroads. They've certainly made inroads. But I think to put to bed some of the questions about the long-term viability of LIV, I think they have to deliver on some of those big initiatives.
So much happening in professional golf. Josh, you've brought a lot of insight to many topics. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, great seeing you guys. Look forward to doing it again soon.
This week, the 10th edition of the Latin America Amateur Championship is being played at Pilar Golf Club in Buenos Aires, Argentina. 72-hole stroke play event with a cut for the leading 50 players plus ties after 36 holes. Some notes on the LAAC. The champion will receive an invitation into the 2025 Masters Tournament and exemptions into the 2025 Open, the 2025 U.S. Open, the 2025 Amateur Championship, and the 2025 U.S. Amateur Championship. With more on this event, Rich Lerner joins us now from site. Great to see you, buddy. What tells you and the organizers that this endeavor, now in its 10th year, is accomplishing its goals?
Damon Eamon, good to be with you. Well, first, it's that gleaming new hotel that I'm staring at right in front of me. 10 years ago, there was nothing here. So infrastructure, number one. But the eye test, if you just walk up and down the range, the swings are better. But then the numbers bear it out, this dramatic improvement. The inaugural Latin America Amateur Championship here at Pilar in Argentina 2015, there were 8 players inside the top 200 of the world amateur golf ranking. Now there are 15 players inside the top 200. Those numbers triple when you go to top 300 and top 500. There are 42 players, Damon, in this field this week who have combined to play in 90, count them, 90 USGA events. More than half the field playing college golf in the United States, or they have recently played college golf in the United States. So what the founding partners, Augusta National, the RNA, and the USGA have done is they haven't just put out empty slogans. We hear it all the time, grow the game. They have put soft spikes on the ground. They've invested in grassroots programs, driving ranges, par threes across the region. And that all leads to these pathways for elite amateurs, the ones we're seeing here today. And then ultimately, many of these players aspire to play professionally. So we talk about the Korn Ferry Tour is getting underway on Golf Channel this week. There are 7 Korn Ferry Tour events in the region in 2025, another half dozen on PGA Tour Americas. This is a region that has more than 650 million people. The growth potential here is tremendous. And again, you tip your cap to these founding partners for recognizing that and investing in it. They've done a phenomenal job.
Rich, you've been around the Latin American Amateur Championship for quite a while. You've seen basically a generation of players come through. It's not an exaggeration to say that some of this talent has proven well able to hold their own in terms of the golf world after the Latin American Amateur.
Eamon, you're right. They're justifiably proud of the success some of the alums have had. You start with Joaquin Niemann from Chile, and I'll never forget on the call back at Prince of Wales in his home country in Chile in Santiago in 2018. He shot 63 final round. He was at that time the number one ranked amateur in the world, so you knew he was special. And he showed us that in the professional ranks. More recently, Nico Echeverria from Colombia finished runner-up at the Sony Open just this past weekend. Two wins the last 2 years on the PGA Tour. He was right here at Pilar in 2015 with Alejandro Tosti of Argentina, who painfully missed a short putt late, but Alejandro Tosti finished runner-up. There are certainly some other players. You know, Mito Pereira almost won the PGA Championship a few years ago at Southern Hills in Oklahoma. Sebastian Munoz has won on the PGA Tour. And then there's Cristobal del Solar. Mr. 57 is an alum of the Latin America Amateur Championship. Shot that 57 on the Corn Ferry Tour and is now a rookie on the PGA Tour. So, yes, plenty of talent that has already made a mark in professional golf. And, you know, the mission here is to create heroes. And if you see what is going on in the junior ranks in Chile or in Mexico, it bears that out. Robust junior programs, great and growing interest in the sport, thanks to what those people have done in this championship.
Yeah, Alejandro Tosti was in the mix all the way up to the end in Houston with Steven Yeager and Scottie Scheffler. So the alums are doing well, Rich, but who are some of the favorites for this year's edition?
Well, Damon, I think you start with the highest-ranked player in those world amateur golf rankings in this field. He's number 13. That is Omar Morales from Mexico. He is out of UCLA. People might remember he hit the opening tee shot at LACC North a couple of years ago at that U.S. Open. Also played the U.S. Open at Pinehurst. And briefly in 2023, just for a couple of minutes, he was leading the U.S. Open. Has played in three PGA Tour events. So he has experience with some of the best players in the world. And he sort of fits the profile of players who've won the Latin America Amateur Championship. Guys, they will come close, they will come back, and then they'll win. So I'm thinking about Joaquin Niemann, who lost in a playoff in 2017, came back and won the following year. Alvaro Ortiz of Mexico lost in a playoff in Panama. He came back and he won at Casa de Campo with a sensational final round 66. Santiago de la Fuente of Mexico was close in this championship, came back and won last year. He beat Omar Morales. So Morales, I think, is a strong favorite here. But then you can't discount one of the past winners, and that is Aaron Jarvis of the Cayman Islands. Small golf footprint, but they're turning out players. Jarvis, by the way, made the cut at the Open at St. Andrews in 2022, and that he has a countryman by the name of Justin Hastings, who has really improved, is playing well out of San Diego State, and has had some good finishes in this championship. And then here for the home country, Argentina, Waco Ludwena is a player to watch. And then I think another a player who fits the profile, you've been close, you keep knocking on the door, is Vicente Marsilio. He just recently graduated Texas Tech, hoping to follow in the footsteps of his college teammate, Callum Scott, who was the silver medalist at Royal Troon, low amateur at the most recent Open. And he put it best. It's almost hard to wrap your head around this, Marsilio. What is at stake here? These three major championships, the invitation to the Masters, and then the exemption to the U.S. Open and the Open. It's a life changer for these guys. This is a really strong field.
Sure is. I've got a soft spot, understandably, for the UCLA Bruin, Omar Morales. Great to see the Latin America Amateur That's Championship right. in its 10th year. Rich, thank you. We'll speak to you tomorrow.
Thank you, guys. Look forward to it.
Back in December, the PGA Tour announced that the Ophelia Project, a nonprofit beneficiary of American Express, had been named the 2024 PGA Tour Charity of the Year. The Ophelia Project is a five-year mentoring program that provides training and education for 300 to 400 girls annually in grades 8 through 12. Mentors help girls develop positive values, graduate on time, and pursue a brighter future. The organization was recently surprised with the honor.
As part of the annual PGA Tour event, American Express, our host organization, Impact Through Golf, Every year we give back money to local Coachella Valley charities. Well, in addition to that, in today's gift, every PGA Tour event to which there's 40 plus submits their recommendation to the PGA Tour for an award, the PGA Tour Charity of the Year. And I'm delighted to tell you today that Ophelia Project has won the PGA Tour Charity of the Year.
And we are pleased to be joined now by Peter Sturgeon, President and CEO of the Ophelia Project. Hey, Peter, what was your reaction to being named PGA Tour Charity of the Year?
Oh my gosh, Damon, I was stunned. I'm still stunned today just at this great honor by the tour to recognize our small local nonprofit here in the Coachella Valley. It's really quite stunning.
Tell us a little bit about the Ophelia Project and the kinds of programs that you're running there, Peter.
Well, like the game of golf and life, I think you really need to be successful. You need a coach, a swing coach. You might need a sports psychologist. You might need a great caddy to get you to be successful. And the similar things we are doing with the Ophelia Project is we are taking adolescent vulnerable girls and we're matching them with mentors, female mentors who come alongside them and support them and encourage them and love them. And at the same time, we're giving them soft set of skills like smart goal setting or how to prevent cyberbullying or self-care, self-worth, some of these things. But at the same time, we're coming alongside of them and supporting them. We're loving them. We're encouraging them. We are saying to them, we see you, we are with you, and we're behind you, and giving them that confidence to succeed. So we've had a great deal of success doing that with young adolescent girls in this valley.
Peter, you really have. 5,400 girls have passed through the program. You have 100% graduation rate. How have you achieved those outcomes?
Well, we're in a challenging community. It's beautiful, as you see, but we do have a lot of challenges. 1 in 12 students drop out before high school, 1 in 12. And if you're a Hispanic girl, 48% of you will become pregnant. So it's really, really important for us to help to keep the girls in school, to give them that confidence that they can succeed and they can dare to fail and at the same time have that fortitude to be successful. So it's really about building confidence, building soft skill sets for them and encouraging them to stay in school, graduate from high school with a goal to move forward, whether it be to junior college, vocational college, university, the military academies, whatever it is, we want them to graduate high school and to have a plan for what's next.
What's the practical use of the money that's donated to the Ophelia Project through American Express and the PGA Tour, Peter? Where do you invest that in your programs?
Well, American Express, first of all, my gosh, they have been so generous with our local community. And I think often that's what's lost when the tour comes to town. We talk about the hotels being busy and the restaurants being busy. But oftentimes, the tournament and the sponsor is really digging down and investing into the local community. And American Express has shown that this year. They've given over $1 million this year to local nonprofits, local charities like us who are doing good work. And so what we are doing with the American Express funds is we're creating the American Express Leadership Scholarships. The last thing we want after the mentors do all this heavy lifting and the girls do all this great work to get through high school is to have their educational pathway derailed because they don't have the funds for books or for breaks for their car to get to school. So we're creating scholarships, and in American Express's umbrella, we're creating the leadership scholarships for girls who really show that instinctual leadership quality that we want to help to grow and encourage. So by American Express's funds and by the PGA Tour's funds, we will be able to lift up these girls, continue them on their educational pathway, and lead them to success.
Certainly a lot of great work for a good cause. Peter, congratulations on the award, and thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you for this opportunity. I'm really grateful for the Golf Channel. Thank you so much.
Golf Today, we'll be back right after this.
We'll be right back.
talking golf today. The DP World Tour wrapped up the Team Cup at the weekend, which pits 10 players from continental Europe against 10 from Great Britain and Ireland, something of a Ryder Cup incubator. GB and I got a comfortable win over continental Europe by a score of 17-8 under the captaincy of Justin Rose. Francesco Molinari was the opposing captain for continental Europe, and afterwards Tommy Fleetwood talked about just how important this event is for the European Ryder Cup squad.
Tommy, a great performance last week by you and your team at the Team Cup. How important is that tournament to everyone who goes on to eventually play or be a captain, vice-captain at the Ryder Cup?
Well, yeah, of course. I said it so many times, you go back to Whiston Straits and we were on the plane home after taking a hammer in and we were looking at what we needed to do over the following 2 years to give ourselves the best chance. Team event was the first thing that came up in our minds. So I think it's played. I think Luke spoke really highly about the tournament after Rome and what an important role it played in leading up to the Ryder Cup. So I think from Luke's perspective, from a vice-captain's perspective, and then players as well, I think it's all... look, you can never replicate the Ryder Cup. Of course you can't, but you're putting yourself in so many similar situations and playing in a team environment, and even the staff to how the nutrition works and everything like that. I think it plays a very big role in what goes on in September. So... on top of that, you know, for us, GB and I, we had a great week. Players played great, and we managed to win a trophy at the start of the year as well, which is a lovely feeling.
How much is it important to you to qualify for the Ryder Cup automatically rather than be picked and give Luke a bit more of a free hand elsewhere?
I think as a goal, it's always your goal to qualify for the Ryder Cup. And even, you know, that was my goal in the last one, which I didn't manage to do. But I, you know, you want to qualify for the Ryder Cup and not rely on a captain's pick, of course. And Luke, you know, I was very grateful that Luke showed his faith in me in the last one and made me one of the six picks. And, you know, it gets harder and harder, really, to qualify. I think even, you know, from my first one in Paris, there was... I feel like it might have gone down to 9 qualifiers at that point, but, you know, it's a big difference from 9 to 6, like 6 and then... the way that the qualifying criteria is now on kind of a world points sort of system, and how strong European golf is, it's very, very difficult to qualify. So if you are actually in those qualifying spots, you've had a great year. So you can look at that from an individual basis on how your year has been as well. I would love to be there in any kind of form. I hope that I'm playing, and I hope that I've been one of the guys that qualified.
From the detritus of defeat at Whistling Straits on a long plane ride home, the mates getting together and talking about what needed to change, and this Team Cup is born. And it just speaks to the soberness and seriousness that the Europeans take in this Ryder Cup. And listen, this was an era where you lose the likes of Westwood and GMAC and Poulter, Stenson, guys you thought would be kind of at the back end, yes, of their playing days, but would be the heart and soul of the European Ryder Cup, and instead it's going to be guys like Tommy Fleetwood.
And this is also as an event very much geared towards the younger generation, kind of your bottom third in terms of experience of a European Ryder Cup team, because it gives them familiarity in the team room. It gives them comfort in certain partnerships. It gives the older guys a head start on the mentorship, so you don't actually have to start doing that on the week of the Ryder Cup. And when you look at the European squad, coming out of Whistling Straits, it seemed to be in a generational crisis. You were wondering where that next generation was coming from. And what we saw in Rome suggested that there is a very strong core on that European team. Now, Fleetwood is obviously part of that. John Rahm presumably will also continue to be part of that. But Rory McIlroy.
Shane Lowry.
Shane Lowry, very much this kind of talismanic figure in the European Ryder Cup team. But Victor Hovland, Ludvig Åberg. You know, there's a lot of talent there. And then this event was very much geared towards the guys who are going to fill out that roster and potentially be recurring factors over the years. You know, Niklas Norgaard, the Højgaards times two in that event as well. There's definitely a value to this that the American team doesn't have, which a lot of it's pressure on scheduling, simply because when they're not playing a Ryder Cup team, the Americans are playing a President's Cup. And that's not any kind of casual incubator of anything. You're under pressure to deliver for your national team then, just as much as you are in a Ryder Cup. So the American squad doesn't actually have the luxury of this event that the European team has. And I think the European team has really maximized the value of it for the people that it's intended to work for.
That's true, but at the same token, I talked to Keegan after, you know, he had the clinching point for the U.S. at the President's Cup, and he said that we're going to take a lot of what Jim Furyk did and try to duplicate it at Bethpage Black in the Ryder Cup. But I'll tell you this, big picture, the road team has to win at some point, whether it's the U.S. overseas or Europe in Farmingdale, Long Island, New York in the fall with the colors changing. Don't you think at some point there has to be a road victory? Otherwise, it's just become, it's a home and home. You're the home squad and you win.
That's what it has certainly turned into over the last decade plus out here in terms of the Ryder Cup results. I also think it's not really an apples to apples comparison taking Jim Furyk's conduct at the President's Cup and moving it across.
Why you say?
Because America actually wins a President's Cup. And more often than not in the last 30 years, they've lost Ryder Cups. I don't know if the players feel more pressure because it's a more storied historical event, but it's certainly true that they're up against stiffer competition on the European side. That was less a divide pre-Liv. Liv took away a lot of folks who were on the international team who can no longer play in a PGA Tour sanctioned event. So the diminishment of the President's Cup has been significant as part of Liv. And it hasn't really impacted the Ryder Cup as much as it has on the other side. But I do think the Americans do feel a tightness when they get there in the Ryder Cup. The record brings on the tightness. And there's a sound factor to the Ryder Cup. I mean, you heard it on the first tee at Rome. You hear it on the first tee at Whistling Straits as well. It's a different environment for
those
guys.
All roads lead to Bethpage Black. Take the LIE. Golf Today is back after this.